Welcome to this podcast from Control Risks, the global specialist risk consultancy. I'm Cass Blayton, and in this episode, we're going to look at the impact of rising tensions between the US and Iran on the political and security risk landscape in the Middle East and beyond. Just a month after Control Risks launched its risk map, which covers the top five risks of business in 2020, the US launched an airstrike that killed the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commander Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi Kafid Hezbollah commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near Baghdad International Airport. On the 8th of January, Iran responded by firing missiles at two US bases in Iraq, and there have been subsequent smaller attacks on US compounds from Iran-backed groups. These events have shaken the Middle East and are likely to have geopolitical consequences far beyond the region. I'm joined today by Graham Griffiths, Emily Knowles, Joseph Buckley, and Cormac McGarry from our Global Risks, Special Risks, Cyber, and Maritime teams here at Control Risks. And this team are going to help us put these events all in perspective for businesses and individuals operating in these areas. Welcome, everyone. If I could turn to you, Graham, first. One of our top five risks in this year's risk map was our assessment that tactical approaches to global issues are really winning over strategy in the political decision making. Graham, could you try and help us understand why this strike has been so important in a long history of tension between the US and Iran? And what it tells us about strategy in the region going forwards.
Thanks very much, Casper. Well, I think it's safe to say that the US strike that killed Qasem Soleimani was a shock to Iran and has forced Tehran to reassess and reevaluate its strategy for resisting the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign. We saw over the course of 2019, Iran respond to this campaign with an escalating series of provocations that included attacks on maritime and energy assets. And it faced very little pushback to this increasingly provocative series of attacks outside of the imposition of new sanctions. The Trump administration has now demonstrated its commitment to enforcing a red line of responding to attacks that kill US citizens, while also showing a willingness to be unpredictable and aggressive in its response. While I think Iran will have to carefully calibrate its actions going forward in order to avoid an undesired military confrontation with Washington, it is unlikely to drop its own campaign of what we've termed maximum resistance or seek diplomatic engagement with the US before the US presidential elections in November. More likely is that Iran will seek to exploit the impact that the US strike has had in Iraq to engineer the US's departure from Iraq. This is likely to include continued attacks by Iran-backed groups on US diplomatic and military assets, in addition to political maneuvering that seeks to end the legal basis for the US's military presence in Iraq. At a broader regional level, Iran is likely to continue to employ the asymmetric, deniable, and proxy capabilities that it has developed to impose a cost on the US and its regional partners, and in order to retaliate over the damage caused to the Iranian economy by US sanctions.
So, Graham, given that we seem to be avoiding, at least for the time being, a large-scale military confrontation between Iran and the United States, are we looking at a scenario commonly called hybrid warfare, whereby parties in the conflict carry on needling the other party through either through deniable attacks or cyber attacks or pressure on shipping through either their own overt use of their own forces or forces allied to them? What's the picture we're looking at there?
Yes, I think that's correct. And we've already begun to see that play out in a few areas that Control Risks has been watching closely, including in the cyber, kidnap, and maritime domains.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, another one of the top five risks that we identified in Risk Map was a ramping up of the level of cyber conflict. So, Joe, what have we seen already in the cyber domain in terms of retaliation, really, from both sides in this sort of Iran-US rivalry sphere?
Thanks, Casper. Excellent question. As we've discussed, Iran knows it doesn't have the capability to directly challenge the US and its allies. We've seen this with the use of proxy actors in the Middle East region, in Iraq and Lebanon, and the impact of Iran's asymmetric tactics were demonstrated with the US killing of Soleimani. Iran will increasingly leverage cyberspace as an avenue to have an asymmetric impact on US organizations and its allies in the Middle East region. We know Iran has focused on the development of disruptive cyber capabilities, and we've seen this with the infamous Shamoon 1, 2, and 3 malware capabilities, which have caused mass data destruction amongst government and oil and gas companies in the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia. We've just seen the use of the Dustman data wiping malware, which is used against Bahraini oil and gas companies, ultimately deleting and destroying reams of data within their servers. Further, Iran has also developed, with the assistance of advanced Russian actors, the capability to disrupt industrial control systems. This is where we expect Iran to become increasingly disruptive, targeting central nodes such as energy grids, the IT supply chain, and communication providers to have mass impact on large numbers of businesses and individuals in the region. We also predict that Iran will increasingly take the fight in cyberspace directly to the US. Before and even after the Soleimani killing, we've seen examples of Iran probing US critical national infrastructure, the energy sector, as well as financial services. However, the US isn't just going to sit back and take this. We think it's likely that the US will become increasingly aggressive in cyberspace against its key adversaries, particularly Iran. We've already seen US Cyber Command openly discuss its offensive cyber capabilities, the targeting of the energy sector, and we've also seen advanced capabilities used against the Iranian military and its intelligence databases, which were used to support the physical targeting of shipping in the region.
Thanks, Joe. The region is no stranger to the crime of kidnap for ransom, and I think a hero control risks. So we think this is another way that Iran or Iran-backed groups might choose to retaliate. If I could turn now to you, Emily. Emily Knowles is a senior analyst in our special risks department here at Control Risks. Emily, what have you been seeing so far?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Casper. I think for us, the events of the 3rd of January really kicked off what we started publishing is a wave of updates on our core platform, just about those increased risks to foreign nationals in countries in the region, particularly in Iraq and then Iran from a detention point of view, but also potentially wider as well. And I think there are a couple of reasons for this and why kidnap for ransom is an attractive option, perhaps, for groups in the region who are looking to retaliate against these strikes. And I think a couple of these are that kidnap for ransom can be quite a deniable form of acting, but it can send a big political message. We've seen Shia groups in the region use kidnap as a way of sending messages like this in the past. I mean, if you think back to the Lebanese civil war and the way that Hezbollah mobilized the large-scale kidnap of foreign nationals to get across a political message, we've seen Shia groups in Iraq use kidnap in Baghdad of international visitors as well, as a way of just kind of cementing that idea that they have control over those regions and they have a way of retaliating. And I think it's important to note as well that Kidnap for Ransom serves a couple of crucial elements for them in terms of reaching out to their support bases in their countries to show that they're maintaining credibility, that they're wanting to avenge the death of Mohandas, especially important for Iraqi-based Shia militia groups. While also keeping below that threshold that you guys have talked about so eloquently, that need to kind of keep beneath a level of retaliation that would invite further large-scale attacks by US forces or its allies. And we've seen a couple of examples of this play out already. So if we look to Iraq, very recently on the 20th of January, we had three French nationals and one Iraqi national go missing who all work for a French NGO in Baghdad. We haven't had that confirmed yet as a kidnap for ransom, but in a separate incident, we had two French journalists kidnapped by suspected members of a Shia militia just outside the US embassy in Baghdad on the 31st of December. So those victims were released very quickly after mediation from the French Foreign Ministry, the Iraqi Prime Minister, the Iraqi National Security Advisor got involved, and also the head of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Shaabi, which is the main Shia militia units in Iraq. And it was kind of coincided with Kataib Hezbollah, one of the Iran-backed units of the Popular Mobilization Unit, storming a US compound, sparking speculation that they could be behind the kidnap for ransom, although this hasn't been confirmed. And I think it's important to note here that these are not being targeted because they're French per se, although it's been French nationals who we've seen affected in these first couple of weeks after the strikes. But kidnapping groups often don't know the nationality of victims before they abduct them. So this is why the messaging that we've been putting out on CORE and elsewhere is that the risk is really raised for all foreign nationals at this time, even though you might say that it would make more sense for these groups to lash out against US nationals given the provenance of the strike. But yeah, I think for us, this is what we've seen playing out so far in Iraq. But looking to the future as well, we would expect that risk to be maintained.
Emily, maybe you could sketch out how this risk will play out in the coming months, possibly even years.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because a lot of groups in this region have had for a long time the capability to carry out kidnap against foreign nationals in their region. They just haven't had the intent piece to. There hasn't been a motivating factor for them to use this as a way of sending a political message. Whereas, you know, this strike against Soleimani and Mohandas kind of changes that balance, but it does it in unpredictable ways. I mean, we saw some of the key heads of popular mobilization units in Iraq come out shortly after the Iranian retaliation and strikes against US bases in the north of Iraq, suggesting that they weren't particularly sold or convinced that this was adequate retaliation, and especially because Mohandas was killed alongside of Soleimani, the pressure on them to show that they're retaliating as well for the death of Mohandas is quite important. And we've also had, you know, Hezbollah leaders, Hassan Nasrallah came out on the 5th of January to say that, you know, the US will pay the price for the killing of Soleimani. And the interesting thing about this as well is that it's not only in the Middle East per se. You can see this being used as a narrative. This death of Soleimani is being instrumentalized as a narrative or a rationale for conducting kidnap for ransom or threat extortion by Shia groups across the world. So for us, as long as these heightened tensions remain, that risk will remain heightened as well. And I think the point to put in here is that threat of detention, political detention, especially in Iran, is historically one of the ways that you can really tell when relationships have hit a low point between Iran and the West. And the most at-risk populations have traditionally been dual nationals, but also foreign journalists, academics, employees of international businesses and tourists are potential targets. And the key risk factor around here is that those detentions can last a long time and people could be charged with a wide range of violations, including espionage, collusion, conspiracy, insulting Islam. And these trials take place often in closed court as well, so it can become exceedingly difficult for international embassies to intervene or to understand what those cases are. So I think, you know, while we're looking at the threat landscape at the moment, kidnap for ransom has to be up there, detention has to be up there as a risk that businesses are looking at for their personnel operating in the region and beyond.
Another area, of course, that tends to bear the brunt of heightened tensions between Iran, the US and Europe is the Strait of Hormuz. Cormac McGarry leads our maritime security business here at Control Risks. And Cormac, it wasn't so long ago that we saw attacks on oil tankers and the detention of vessels in the Strait. Is this something we'd expect to pick up given recent events?
From a maritime security perspective, you know, this is a particular threat environment that is intrinsically linked to political tensions and to regional dynamics. So understanding that threat to your ship, for example, means understanding the broader regional picture, which Graham has laid out. So, you know, from that picture and also analysis of the attacks and the seizures that you mentioned that we saw in 2019, we can extrapolate essentially two or three types of threat that are facing vessels in the year ahead. Firstly, this stems from the asymmetric, deniable and calculated nature of tactics that have been deployed in the region and that were demonstrated in May and June last year when six tankers were attacked. Secondly, there's the threat of harassment and seizure, as we saw with the Stena Impero last year. And then finally, there's this kind of worst case scenario, which is the one that hits the media headlines more often, I think, which is the potential of a full closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which of course is a vital shipping strait. And so to identify how those three types of threat hit your vessel, again, really goes back to understanding that broader regional picture and geopolitical context, which Graham laid out. So what that means in the year ahead is that if you are an owner or operator of vessels going into the Gulf region and through the Strait of Hormuz, you really need to assess the threat based on each individual vessel and not simply blanket a level of risk across the region. So that means considering very specific issues for each vessel, such as what's the type of vessel? Is it an oil and gas tanker, for example, versus a supply and support vessel? What flag is the ship registered under? What's the port of origin and destination? What cargo is it carrying? Is it working on critical national infrastructure? So these are some of the elements that a shipping company or operator should be considering in the year ahead.
Great. Thank you very much indeed, Cormac. And well, that about brings us to the end of this podcast. The eagle-eared amongst you will have noticed the Skype quality of that. Our analysts are coming into this call from all across the world. Graham Griffiths is in Dubai. Emily Knowles and Joseph Buckley are here in London. Cormac McGarry's on the road. And so thanks for bearing with the quality of that. If you subscribe to Core, you can find much more of this analysis on the Core platform. And if not, please do visit our website, controlrisk.com. I'm Casper Layton. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Control Risks, and bye-bye for now.